I'm currently working as an administrator, like a medical administrator and an inventory specialist at a dermatologist's office.
This is Joel Antigua, speaking with us from southeastern Michigan, near the state's border with Ohio.
That's my first job, but my main work is essentially a courier. So I'm a medical courier, or pretty much transport whatever through my car. And when I started, it started out with your basic stuff, you know, like your Ubers and your Lyfts. And then I started building relationships and then moved towards medical couriers. Like during the pandemic, it was moving COVID samples. And then that kind of graduated up into getting my own van, moving expedited freight, you know, for automotive parts, things that needed to be moved ASAP. It changes from time to time, but now it kind of settled into moving animal specimen from veterinary clinics. The job that I do during the day with the doctor is essentially my day job, you can say, that gives me medical insurance and gives me stability.
Joel prefers this courier work to driving for the rideshare apps, where the schedules and the number of rides are just too unpredictable.
When you work Uber and Grubhub and Lyft and all that good stuff, your pay is based on the demand, on who needs a ride, right? Or who's ordering food. And on top of that, you not only have to deal with that, but in that industry, you also have to deal with how many drivers are doing it, because they sign up drivers every day. So sometimes when you're sitting on the app with Uber and Grubhub and Lyft, you're waiting for orders, and you can be waiting for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours. And sometimes you'll get one order inside that time, and that order will only pay you $6. I went to school for supply chain. And when I was doing that and I was working for Ford and I was in the materials management office, I was not happy. I was not happy. I was making what people think is money, but I was not happy. I mean, we know a lot of people who are living that, where they go to work. It's the same thing every day, Monday through Friday, sometimes Saturday. They come home, they're exhausted. They don't have the bandwidth to do things they love, because they're taking all that bandwidth and they're giving it to a job that they don't truly love. They don't truly enjoy. You know what I'm saying? So they come home and exhausted. They don't have time to work out. They don't have time to socialize. And to me, life is too short to kind of give up and relinquish, I guess you can say, surrender yourself to that.
Joel has other interests that courier work allows him to pursue.
I'm huge into investing. I'm an investor. So I break my back, I work hard, but on the outside, I invest into assets. We don't have to talk about what assets they are. Everyone has different opinions on that. But I invest in lots of assets. We take our money, and my point is that I found a way like to leverage what I'm doing and use what I'm doing to work for me. So I knew, okay, I'm not a doctor. I knew I'm not an engineer. I could have kept on my track and finished my doctorates and became a professor. But I said, okay, wait a minute. I want more time for my family. I want more time for myself. I want more time to do the things I love. And I'm pretty active. I'm athletic. I love jiu-jitsu. I love running. I love working out. And I want to spend time with my wife and my kid when he comes, and my family. I knew I couldn't do that if I were to take the traditional route.
In the past 2 to 3 years, we've seen an explosion in the number of workers either supplementing or replacing traditional 9-to-5 jobs with gig work of some kind. People like Joel use gig work to maintain a certain work-life balance, but also to have the flexibility to pursue other interests. But as more people flock to these types of jobs, what are the implications for workers and the economy when the side hustle becomes the hustle? Welcome to Know What You See. I'm Brian Lowry, professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. In this season of the podcast, I'm taking a look at the shifting world of work, who and what shapes these changes, and what they mean for us. The rise of technology companies like Uber or TaskRabbit have made it possible for more workers than ever to participate in gig work. In 2021, the Pew Research Center found that 16% of Americans earned money from an online gig platform. doing things like assembling furniture, delivering food, or doing housework. And as we've heard, these task-based jobs are generally seen as a good way to make extra money or to control how much and when you work. But it's unregulated employment, without benefits or work protections. What's the state of gig work today and where is it going?
Justin Wolfers. I'm a professor of economics and public policy at the University of Michigan.
I asked Justin to start by explaining how we got here. What's causing this rapid growth in the gig industry?
I think you've got to start with technology. This is the thing that matches people on the buy side with people on the sell side. In some sense, it's always been gig work. You can think about often immigrant labor meeting on a particular street corner, and then contractors would drive up with half-empty trucks and call 2, 4, 6, 8 guys to jump aboard, and that would be their day's work. So that's a high-frequency labor market. These aren't career contracts they're forcing. They're day-long contracts, much like Uber. The thing that's different now, though, is, of course, each of us is in the safety of our own home staring at our cell phone and can decide what to work, how, why, and when. So one part of it is technology's enabled mass many-to-many matching. And then the other is it's a really, in some cases, very clever use of capital. Running a taxi company required buying a lot of taxis. Running Uber required writing a lot of code.
What counts as gig work? Define it for me.
Well, I don't think anyone's got a definition. There is a little bit of the elephant about it. You know it when you see it. And it's actually something that economists have struggled to measure what's going on in the gig economy for precisely this reason. TaskRabbit definitely feels like gig work. The gig there is come and build my IKEA shelves. It's a two-hour job. Uber is called gig work, but many people make careers driving Ubers the same way they used to for taxis. And so in many respects, that work from the worker's side looks precisely the same as it would have in the olden days. So I think, Brian, you just tricked me into admitting that it seems almost impossible to define. So why don't you help me?
I don't know. I think the way people have thought about it in the past, right? Because the first use of it, as far as I know, was around music, right? So there were musicians they would talk about getting gigs. And so I think of it as people doing short-term jobs for a set amount of money, right? So it's usually, I guess it would be an implicit contract often in the olden times. And now I guess some version of that that's more formalized. A colleague of mine told me back in his day, so he's older, he's an academic, no one thought about careers. You just had a job. You just showed up and did something and people paid you, but there was no career. And I think maybe gig work is becoming a thing because we had learn to think in terms of long-term careers with a certain type of continuity, mm-hmm. and gig work is breaking the sense of continuity.
So by this view, it's a lot about much more control on the supply side. A taxi driver in the old days was told to work Monday to Friday, and you either got mornings or you got evenings, and your shift was 12 hours because that's what the boss said. Although that's not quite true. You had the car for 12 hours. You're allowed to then return it whenever the heck you wanted. Whereas an Uber driver can control their schedule much more finely.
Mm-hmm. How has the growth in this kind of work affected the economy? So you talked about measurement, so that's one thing. But how for the average person, how should they think about the effect of gig work on the broader economy?
Well, there's two ways I think you want to think about it. One is on the labor supply side. And what's interesting about the way you defined gig work as workers having immense control on the supply side is you actually managed to make it sound wonderful. Lots of labor advocates don't talk about it that way. And that's because it also lacks an enormous amount of regulation. You're usually working one way or another as your own boss, which is wonderful. It sounds like control, but it then means you're not covered by minimum wages and various other protections. And so that would be worrying. And then there's the consumer side, which is, frankly, life is better when you can call someone to drop by with takeout, or you can call an Uber to get you to the airport, or you can have someone to build your IKEA furniture. So I think there's tremendous gains on the consumer side. Part of this is about using capital that was being otherwise underused. So there was lots of cars in driveways, but then a taxi company would go and buy even more cars. Well, now let's just use the cars in the driveways. That's somewhat less compelling than thinking about Airbnb. That really is a very intense use of capital that otherwise, in many cases, think about people's second homes, was remaining completely unused. And so it may be that someone had a second home that was worth $500,000 that was empty 6 months of the year. So now that capital is really being used a lot more aggressively. That's the source of the gains. Then the next question is, who gets those gains? Does it go to consumers as lower prices? Does it go to gig workers in greater flexibility and in some cases, better incomes? And that's certainly true for people who had second homes. Or does it go to, like, Uber doesn't have a lot of competitors and it tells its drivers what price it's paying them. One imagines Uber's doing pretty well out of this too.
When you point to the use of underutilized assets, right? So that cars just sitting in driveways or the home sitting empty, that seems like a gain for the economy, right? So you had these underutilized assets that are now being put to work in some way. So which means that there have been an expansion in what's available and so the goods that are being produced by the society in some way. And the question is, how are those gains being allocated?
There are two ways of thinking about this. And so we've only talked about the first, which is we're growing the pie. Who's getting the biggest slice? As far as we can tell, Uber drivers are not exactly making buck. They can make enough money driving a car that they're doing okay, much the same way that taxi drivers did, but they're not earning huge gains. Customers, I think, are getting huge gains in terms of really pretty reasonable prices. And I think most people think better service. The reason I don't take taxis and I do take Ubers is because the service on average is frankly higher quality. The company itself is taking an enormous cut. That's not to say the workers aren't gaining. Possibly what they're gaining is flexibility and ability to schedule. So if you were going to earn $12 an hour driving a taxi around New York, you can earn the same $12 an hour, but decide when and when you want to clock on and clock off. That's a much more valuable job. And it's also one that can fit in when people have intermittent careers or intermittent income needs. I met a driver the other day who was going to keep driving until he earned enough money that he could buy tickets to the football game. And that's an opportunity he would not have otherwise had. That's the first model. The first model is the pie got bigger. And that pie got bigger through creating greater convenience and using capital assets. The second model is, this is a regulatory end run that if you wanted to employ someone to build your IKEA furniture, it used to be you had to hire a carpenter who would be covered by perhaps by a union or otherwise by minimum wage laws. And right now you can go to TaskRabbit and hire someone at what in many cases turns out to be an incredibly low wage. So that's a pure regulatory end run. That was the claim that the taxi companies made against Uber. We have to obey all these laws, you don't. Now, how do you feel about this? If the laws that it's an end run around a kind of dumb that can grow the pie. And so the taxi industry was terribly overregulated. And so an end run around bad laws grows the pie, but an end run around good laws can end up with people being exploited. And I guess the third thing we have is gig work that travels across borders. A friend who wanted to send me a sticker, a fun little thing, and he wanted a cool design. And he put it up on Upwork or one of these other platforms. And someone in Pakistan made it, did a lovely little graphic design for him for $15. 30 other people bid for that work. So we now have access to labor in Pakistan and many other countries that we previously wouldn't have. That's partly because the product now is bits and bytes and the product now can get zapped across borders in a way it couldn't before. One perspective is, well, he was exploiting someone in Pakistan, paying them rates that would be unacceptable to a graphic designer in the United States. Another perspective is that guy wouldn't have been doing anything more valuable with that hour. We know that because he chose to give up the hour and earn the $15. And so maybe what we're doing is actually helping that fellow in Pakistan. One thing we do know is that it's certainly not going to increase the wage of competitors in the United States. If I've now got the option to go to Pakistan instead, that will hurt certain often lower wage workers.
I wonder if this is going to lead to increased economic inequality. So on one hand, Airbnb, if you have a second home, you already have significant assets, and now you're just extracting more from that existing asset. And you compare that to the service industry, where it's not clear that you are significantly better off financially anyway than if you had been a taxi driver. In fact, as far as I know, you could be worse off a little bit. I just don't know how that works out. So when you start to think about the people who own the assets versus the people providing services And you can think of not just gig work, because we talked about as work, but there's also the sharing economy, which kind of gets lumped into the gig economy, however you think about that. But basically, people who have assets, is it possible they're going to see really large gains where the people who provide the services through these platforms are not seeing very much gain, which could lead to increased or exacerbated inequality?
You want to think about, in any of these things, why the hell does it exist as a gig job? I roughly gave three categories. The first is more intense use of existing assets. Well, that's only going to benefit people with assets. So Airbnb is fantastic for people with a home in the Hamptons. That's not going to help your average American. And we see that run out very quickly. Like, very little of the gains of Uber are actually about cars. Cars cost $15,000. A home in the Hamptons costs $15 million. So it's got to be about really, really important assets. So the second is we could have an end run around regulation. So we are now hiring our taxi drivers, but we're not hiring them. They're in many cases independent contractors who will end up in many shifts working for very, very low wages, sub-minimum. So that's going to screw the poor right there. And then the third example I gave is much of this is happening internationally in international trade. So it depends which inequality you care about. Now you've got low-wage workers in America competing with low-wage workers in Pakistan. That's going to be bad for American low-wage workers. But if what you cared about was global inequality, anything that creates a closer connection between American consumers and the rest of the world is going to be good for workers in the rest of the world. They're going to see more of our demand. So that's the three categories giving you three different answers. Let me give a step back, which is to say we've only been thinking about the supply side, and I'm an economist, so I have to say, remember, there's another side, the demand side. And that is the gains that each of us enjoy from buying this stuff. Now, I'm just thinking off the top of my head, and Brian, maybe you can help me here. It seems that many of the products that people are buying through the gig economy are still particularly attractive to higher income people. So a vacation at an Airbnb, at a minimum, that's helping the middle and upper middle class, quite likely even the very rich. But working class families who are typically going to visit relatives instead, it's not affecting them at all. Paying someone else to drive you around, that kind of sounds like a higher end activity. Paying someone else to build your IKEA furniture. My working class stepfather would have built his own. Paying someone on the other side of the world to do some kind of knowledge work, from designing a sticker to creating a small app for you. Again, probably those consumer benefits are going at the higher end of the income distribution, but not entirely.
And so I just wonder how that plays out over the long term. Help me think about what that looks like 10, 15 years, 20 years from now.
So one possibility is the politics changes. And again, if you think much of what's going on here is an end run around regulation, maybe we regulate. And certainly, you know, California and Uber and the move towards are they independent contractors versus employees is an example of that. It wouldn't be surprising if the Biden administration had a particular, really wanted to put more of the gig economy into the regulated labor market. So that would be one possibility. Another is this continues to grow. It's the unregulated sector, and an unregulated sector is going to outcompete a regulated sector. And add on, if you've got various technological advantages from many to many matching and the like, then it becomes an increasingly large share of the economy. I sometimes wonder, to take a product that you can't imagine going to the gig economy anytime soon, the product I sell, which is economics lectures. I don't quite know why it's not a gig economy job.
I was going to say, feel like it could easily become a gig economy job, right?
Absolutely. I mean, and the thing is, and by jingo, the pandemic has taught us this, many of us working in the service economy can get all of our work done by bits and bytes flowing over the internet in a way that we never understood before. Mm-hmm. And so that makes it particularly open to gig work, to international trade and globalization. And also, a market like economics lectures is very different than a market for taxi rides, because a million people can watch an economics lecture. Only four people can fit in the back of a car. And so there, the dynamics would be very differently, which is economics lectures would become a lot more like pop music, where everyone listens to the same top 10 and we economists get to compete for who really is most like Britney or Beyonce. And so that would create massive inequality. in these markets where you can serve many, many consumers at the same time. But I'm not quite sure whether we end up calling that gig economy anymore. I guess we don't. We just call that selling.
Let's turn away from the gig economy for a moment and press on the downside of what we're talking about here, which is fewer choices. I asked Justin if he thinks the variety or number of things on the market, goods or services, would get reduced. So to continue that pop music analogy, might we start to see a smaller number of stars with huge hits?
I would imagine that would occur. The terms I'd use to describe it might be very different. My friends in the humanities would be terrified and think it awful that the set of choices would diminish. But what would happen is the choices that no one chose would fall away. A library that's full of books that no one's reading doesn't seem that much more interesting than a library that has a small number of books that everyone reads.
Except if I like a genre that goes away, then it's kind of bad for me.
You're the loser. That's right. But the point is that either you value choice for its own reasons, right? You just think a healthy cultural economy requires a library with many, many books. Or you think that many people have very, very disparate tastes. If that's the case, though, then the library is actually going to keep serving those many different niches.
There's also the benefit of having serendipity for the possibility of producing something that everyone would want, right? So there might be some obscure book that no one really knows of today that generated the genre that dominates, right?
Yep.
And you would lose that.
Right. So this is the claim that choice is more valuable than any of us individually would say out loud. I think that's right. Now, let's bring that back to the gig economy. I've spent time on sites like Upwork, and I've realized there are people I can hire to do things where I would never have even thought to buy the thing or do the thing. I was working on my textbook, and I realized I could hire a little cartoonist to make beautiful cartoon art in the margins. Maybe there's a little bit of serendipity as you start to search through the extraordinary array of talents that people out there have and are willing to sell.
And so speaking of that, has this changed how you think about individuals' relationship to work? So you're talking about writing a textbook, so that's work for you, and you're doing it. I assume you're doing it as a full, there's no gig component of it. Someone gave you a contract, you're writing the book, you hope to sell a bunch of books. But you're engaging with people in different ways now than you would have because of the gig economy. Like you see, I can get a cartoon in the margin. I'm just wondering how we think about how people will experience work if this continues.
Those forces already existed. And in many respects, much of what looks like the real economy, when you look into it, turns out to be a gig economy. So let me tell you more than you care about when it comes to textbook publishing. You might think when you walk into a big building in Manhattan that says Macmillan Publishers, you would find lots of editors and art people and all sorts of things inside. Turns out the guys who draw my graphs are in some other country. They're called the studio and I'm never allowed to talk to them and they don't talk to me and they're on contract and they get X dollars per graph. The guys who typeset my book are in another country and I have nothing to do with them. It turns out the folks that code it for an ebook are in another country. And so actually you walk into the building and there's surprisingly few book people. That happens in many, many industries. This is what we call, you teach it at business school, core competencies. Right? It turns out General Motors doesn't actually really make cars, right? They buy a bunch of components and then they ship them to Detroit. And then we employ guys to put those components together. So there's nothing intrinsically gig about this. This is the question of, what are the limits of the firm? How much should you do versus how much should you bring in from elsewhere? The words economists use for this is it's make versus buy. In producing your output, how much should you make versus how much should you buy from elsewhere?
How does this relate to the alienation from the work you're producing or the alienation from the product, right? So when you disaggregate the work at this level, right, or the product, mm-hmm. let's say, right? So a car, you're right, they're not making cars, they're assembling cars. And there's a difference. I think that's the distinction you'd make. When you don't feel connected to a larger purpose, or it's hard to see the meaning of what you're producing because it's such a small component of the overall thing that's being produced. Does that change in your mind how people engage with work? Is there any consequence of that?
It's a really interesting question. Let me try and give one side of the argument and then I'll see if I can figure out the other. So Ford used to make everything, used to grow the rubber for the tires that it would put into the car. But if you're a guy who worked on the rubber farm, my guess is you spent all day staring at rubber trees. And so my guess is you are kind of alienated the same way right now. Instead, what Ford does today is it buys rubber on the market. That rubber is produced by a farmer on a rubber farm. So my guess is there's still a guy who stares at rubber trees all day. Then the question is, well, by one view, that's the same, right? A different view is that's different. So the Marxist perspective would be, well, it used to be that he felt part of some larger whole and understood himself not as a rubber farmer, but as a car maker. And you can imagine this bigger firm that he was a part of that employed engineers and metal workers and so on. A different view is he used to work for the Ford company, which was full of middle managers who were kind of jerks and always punched down. And today, he's not just a rubber farmer. He's a rubber entrepreneur who decides how many rubber trees he plants and decides who he's going to sell them to. And if you treat him badly, he's not going to sell you his rubber. Brian, I don't know which one's right, but it's not obvious that being part of a larger company necessarily makes you more alienated from your work product. And actually, if you think about much of what the gig economy is doing, it's not really the profoundly alienating work of screwing lids on toothpaste tubes. Upwork is largely about creative work. And it's about people taking their abilities as coders and designers and so on. The last time I had someone build some IKEA shelves for me, it was someone who had retired and wanted to keep their brain active and were pretty good with their hands. And this was a form of work that they found really useful for them. So I'm not sure that there's a ton of extra alienation. It necessarily comes out of the gigness of the gig work. In fact, the gigness, as we described before, is workers having immense control over things like schedule and customers.
So for better or worse, when you work at the Ford company, you have an identity as a Ford employee. Right. Mm-hmm. And there's still, yep. I mean, people take pride in like being Google, absolutely. I don't know, or being at Facebook or wherever they, you know, these now tech firms. When you have gig work, I wonder how you think about how people identify, not with the work, but with what it means to be a worker.
Again, I think we have to come back to this question of what does it mean to be the gig economy? One of the definitions we started with was immense control over you, when, where, how, and what you work on. So you're right. They would no longer say, if I drive people around in the back of a car, I would no longer say I'm a taxi driver. It's possible I'd say I'm an Uber driver, but it's also possible I'd say I work for me. I'm the boss. I don't take orders from no one. So said that way, the identity is one of entrepreneur. And again, I think the meaning that different people find in their work is going to vary across people. And obviously, now you're going to cringe when an economist says this. Much of this is socially constructed. How'd you like that?
You know, it's funny. I say this all the time. Like the only social scientists I know who don't believe in or understand social construction are economists.
Did I just show that we don't?
No. You actually were disconfirming of that hypothesis.
So. Okay. All right.
So we've all been through this pandemic. Gig work, whatever you think about that. I'm just wondering, for you, what's been the most profound consequence of the pandemic?
I think it's the obvious one, which is more work can be done separate from colleagues than we'd ever previously understood. And so I think that has tremendous implications, not just for the future of work, but the future of cities and how we organize work. It's not all good. I've been incredibly lonely at times. It's not all bad. My childcare needs have been a whole lot easier when I haven't had to be in at the office. This genuinely is a once in a generation, once in a lifetime opportunity to reorganize the world of work. It's utterly clear that those of us in upper middle class, white collar, highly well remunerated jobs are using that opportunity. What's less clear is how far through the distribution that will stretch. And I think that's the real policy challenge, which is to take a set of people who've not historically been empowered within the labor market, and can they find ways in which we can take these new understandings of all the different ways in which we can work remotely so that they can also reap some of the benefits.
What are you most optimistic about, and what should people most be concerned about?
What am I most optimistic about? That we can find, and we have a moment that allows us to explore new models of work and new organizations of work. The problem in 2019, so in 2019, there was lots of people who'd rather 3-day weekends. The problem is, in 2019, any employer who said, I'm going to have a four-day work week and a three-day weekend, the people they're most likely to attract are going to be the workers they're not going to want. And so it just became a self-confirming equilibrium that we lived in a labor market that was a rat race. It was a rat race because if you tried to deviate from the rat race, you'd get the workers you didn't want. All that goes out the window when people aren't coming in for other reasons. I don't think the US is going to do it in a hurry, but this idea that we do 2 weeks of annual leave is insane. And so a whole lot of the ways in which we structure work were stuck, and we got a chance to be unstuck. And hopefully we can grab it. So that, I think, is what I'm optimistic about. Pessimistic, there's sort of like an iron rule, which is when you give people new ways of screwing other people, they figure out how to do it. And so one might worry that the reorganization of work will discover new ways of exploiting people. One might hope we discover new ways of empowering people. And so maybe the next few years are going to be a race between exploitation and empowerment.
All right. Well, I certainly hope we get to empowerment, but I fear that we're going to continue to do what we have been doing.
Good luck to us all.
Yeah, indeed. But I really appreciate the time. Thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure, Brian.
Know What You See is produced by PRX in collaboration with the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Our production team is Jocelyn Gonzalez, Amy Chan, Jonathan Cabral, and Florence Burrow Adams from PRX Productions. Executive producer from the Stanford Graduate School of Business is Bernadette Clavier, with content production by Katie Wallace. For more about me or the show, go to knowwhatyouc.com. Be sure to like and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Thanks for listening.